All right, hello everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Quantum Gravity Seminar. So today we had Edward Wilson Ewing, that probably most of you know, and he's in the University of New Brunswick, so not to talk to him. And he's gonna tell us about resolving the H-naught tension with diffusion. So no further ado, I'll let Ed take the stage.
All right, thank you very much. Hello, everyone. Given the situation, I'd like to start just by saying that I hope that you and all of your families are all healthy and doing well. I'd like to thank Daniele for the invitation to give this seminar. So my plan is to present an idea on how quantum gravity effects could affect late-time cosmologies. So we usually think of quantum gravity effects being important in the early universe, but here I want to share some ideas of how they could be important in the late universe also. And my goal here is really to focus on the main idea rather than on some technical aspects. So I've purposefully made the talk a little bit short, just really focus on the main idea. And of course, if you have questions, I'll be happy to discuss at the end. All right. So the main motivation that I have here is to try and understand if there are microscopic geometric degrees of freedom coming from some theory of quantum gravity, and how this could affect physics in general, and in particular, late-time physics. So, of course, as we all know, the existence of atoms and molecules can be inferred by many different physical phenomena, and one classic example is Brownian motion. Another example that's very well known is diffusion. So, of course, energy is always conserved, but it can be transferred. And in particular, it's often transferred from macroscopic objects to microscopic degrees of freedom that we can't see, at least not very easily. And so I want to take that idea and transfer it to microscopic geometric degrees of freedom. And I want to ask the question of whether it might be possible for energy to be transferred to these microscopic geometric degrees of freedom from matter fields. And if this is possible, how exactly would this transfer happen? And would there be any observational consequences? And my goal in this talk is to explore this possibility using a classical framework that allows for diffusion to be present. So here, my goal is not to start from a specific candidate theory of quantum gravity and to try to calculate exactly how diffusion like this could arise. And this is something that's important, I think, is a big question for future work in this direction, but rather I want to do something that's a little bit simpler. I want to work within a classical framework and see what happens if I'm able to turn diffusion on within that framework. Okay, so of course, in general relativity, we can't have any diffusion from matter to some microscopic geometric degrees of freedom simply because the stress energy tensor is conserved. So if we take the divergence of the stress energy tensor, we get zero, as you see in equation one. And of course, we can always transfer energy between different matter fields. So for example, if I have a field phi and I have another field chi, then the stress energy tensor of those individual fields may not be preserved if there are interactions between these two fields, but the total stress energy tensor in the context of general relativity will still be conserved. However, there is a different theory for gravity that does allow for diffusion, where the total stress energy tensor for all matter is not necessarily conserved, and that's unimodular gravity. So to see how this works, I'll want to give a bit of background on unimodular gravity. This is a theory that's been around for a long time, so I won't be able to go through all of the history of all the people who have worked on it and examining different aspects. But let me just focus on its formulation as the trace-free version of the Einstein equations. So you simply take the Einstein equations and you remove the trace and you're left with what you see as equation four here. So this is similar to what you have in standard general relativity, but it's slightly different. Now, before returning to equation four in more detail, I want to point out that unimodular gravity has a very important property. And this property is that vacuum energy does not couple to the metric. So if we have a perfect fluid with some energy density, some pressure, and some forward velocity, we have the stress energy tensor, which is shown in 5. And this is true for any perfect fluid. This doesn't depend on the background. And we can easily calculate what the right-hand side to equation 4 is from this. And we see that we get a prefactor of rho plus the P, so the energy density plus the pressure. And if we have a vacuum energy, then the pressure is equal to minus the energy density, and this vanishes. So if you have vacuum energy, the right-hand side of equation 4 becomes 0. And what this means is that vacuum energy won't couple to the metric in unimodular gravity. And a consequence of this is that this weakens the cosmological constant problem. So in unimodular gravity, it's still not obvious why the cosmological constant is so small. So that part of the cosmological constant problem is still present. But on the other hand, you don't have the problem that you have these apparently huge contributions coming from vacuum energy. So vacuum energy no longer couples. So that part of the problem is resolved in unimodular gravity. So this is one reason why unimodular gravity is very interesting. Okay, so let me now return to equation 4. So these are the equations of motion for unimodular gravity. And that tells you about the geometric sector. Now, for matter, what you can do, if you wish, is to add the condition that the divergence of the stress energy tensor vanishes. And this is commonly done in the literature. So often, people will then add in this extra condition. But I want to stress that adding this condition is not at all necessary. So in full generality, the divergence of the stress energy tensor could be non-zero. So there could be some current that carries away some energy from the stress energy tensor. And it turns out that this isn't entirely free. And so some of the symmetries of unimodular gravity tell us that the exterior derivative of this current J has to vanish. So what we see is that in unimodular gravity, there is a way for diffusion to occur where energy is lost from the matter fields. So of course, the immediate question to ask now is, if this does happen, where does the energy go? And how does that affect the physics? How does that affect the equations of motion that we have? And to see what happens, I think it's helpful to rewrite the trace free Einstein equations. So equation 4 on this slide here, in a more familiar way. So to do that, we can take the divergence of the trace free Einstein equations and we can use the Bianchi identities. And that gives equation 8. And we see on the right that we have this current that shows up that tells us about how the stress energy tensor is not quite conserved. So how much diffusion shows up. Now we can integrate equation 8 and we can plug that back in to the equation that we started with and we get equation 9. And what we see is that on the left-hand side of equation 9, the first two terms combine to give the Einstein tensor. And then we have some prefactor which I'll return to. So let me show that here, this lambda naught plus this integral over some path L of J times the metric is equal to 8 pi G times the stress energy tensor. So this is very much like the Einstein equations. And the only difference is that instead of having a cosmological constant here, I have this combination. So here, lambda naught, the first term is just a constant of integration. And the second term is the integral of my diffusion current J here along some path. So we have to fix an initial point in our space-time. And then we evaluate the integral along the path to the point that you're interested in. And what's important is that, as I mentioned earlier, we have the condition that the exterior derivative of J must vanish. And that implies that this integral is independent of the path that you choose. So really, I can replace this combination of lambda naught plus the integral over the path of J as some field which depends on space-time position. And what this means is that now we have a set of equations of motion that look very much like the usual Einstein equations of general relativity, except that now we have a cosmological term. I won't use constant anymore because it's not constant. We have a cosmological term, lambda, which depends on space-time position. So that is the difference when you work in unimodular gravity and you don't force the stress energy tensor to be conserved. Okay, so this is very general. And now I would like to go on and see what happens in cosmology. So if we look at the cosmological sector, the easiest thing and the first thing to do is to look at a flat Friedman metric. So we have our scale factor A, and the expansion rate of the universe is given by the Hubble rate. And because of the symmetries, we also have that this diffusion current only has a component in the t direction, and this component only depends on t. So this just follows from the symmetries of homogeneity and isotropy. So with this, we can go ahead and look at the equations of motion coming from unimodular gravity. And we find that we get the Friedman equation that we normally have here in equation 11. And the only difference is that now the lambda depends on time. It's no longer constant. And what's interesting is that if you have diffusion in unimodular gravity, you necessarily get a dynamical lambda of t. Sorry, was there a question? Okay, not let me continue. So this is the effect of diffusion. And also, it's important to point out that this is the only effect. So the equations of motion aren't modified in any other way. The only thing that happens here is that the cosmological constant now depends on t. Yes, I think there's a question.
Yeah, Lee?
Yes, hi. We ran into something like this in joint work with a bunch of people. Isn't this the result of a conformal transformation on the metric? Having a cosmological constant that in the Friedman-Robinson-Walker case can depend on the time?
It might be possible to rewrite it that way, yes. I'm not 100% sure, but I think that might be another way of putting it.
Let's come back at the end and discuss the implications of that.
Okay, sure. Thank you. Okay, so just to summarize again, we've turned on this diffusion term, and what happens is that now we have a lambda which depends on time. Okay, now the specific functional form of lambda, so is this some linear growth or is it something more complicated? This will depend on the rate of diffusion from the matter fields to the microscopic geometric degrees of freedom according to this framework. And so this will have to be fixed by some input from fundamental physics. So if we have a tentative theory of quantum gravity, then perhaps this will give us some argument to say, this is exactly the form that diffusion, this is exactly the rate that diffusion should occur at, and then we can calculate what lambda of t is. But today I really want to stay at a more phenomenological level. So all I'll do for now is I'm going to assume that lambda of t is increasing with time, following arguments that the diffusion is transferring energy from matter to geometry. And later on, I'll posit two very simple phenomenological models that we can look at. now let's leave that free and just try to understand what effect this could have. So if diffusion does indeed generate an evolving cosmological constant, or I shouldn't use constant, but an evolving cosmological term lambda, what possible effects could we look for? And this, of course, will lead to departures from what we normally have for the dynamics of standard GR lambda CDM cosmology. And so one reasonable place to look is to look for what might appear to be discrepancies between different observations if you try to reconcile them using GR lambda CDM. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to shift gears a little bit and go and look at some observations that, according to GR lambda CDM observations, are hard to reconcile. And one example that I want to focus on today is the Hubble tension. So let me tell you a little bit about the Hubble tension. So H naught is the value of the Hubble rate today. This has been measured very accurately in two different ways. So first we have supernova observations, which give a value of H naught of 73.5 plus or minus 1.5 approximately kilometers per second per megaparsec. We can also measure the H naught, the value of H naught, by looking at the data from the cosmic microwave background and assuming dynamics governed by general relativity and lambda CDM. And then we find that H naught is 67 plus 4 plus or minus 0.5 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So we have approximately a 10% difference between these two measurements, which have both have relatively small error bars. And these differences are statistically significant at the level of 4.2 sigma. So this is quite strong. I should mention that there's a different calibration that can be done for the supernova observations. And in this case, you get a value of H naught, which is a fair bit smaller. Now, these are observations which are quite recent, and I expect that in the future, this error bar of this last observation here, which is currently 2.5, will decrease. And that will tell us a little bit more about how statistically significant this tension is. So at this point, I think it's fair to say that it's not entirely clear whether there's some unknown systematic error in the observations and in the analysis, or whether this is a sign of new physics. So here, I'm going to consider the possibility that this really does indicate the need for new physics and follow that path. But I think it is important to keep in mind that at this stage, it could still be due to some unknown systematic error. Okay, let me say a little bit more about each of the two ways to measure the value of H naught. So the more direct way to measure it is if you look at type 1a supernova and you measure their magnitude, the brightness, and their redshift. And from that, if you assume a fall off in their brightness that goes as 1 over what's known as the luminosity distance squared, we can calculate what this luminosity distance is and plot this in comparison to its redshift. Then we know how the scale factor evolves, and we can just do a Taylor expansion of that. And what's really important here is really just the first two terms, but of course there are higher order terms included here just for completeness, but it's really the first two terms that are very important in this case. And from that, if we do a short calculation, we see that we get this relationship between the luminosity distance DL and Z. And if we plot these all the data points, then we can find what the preferred value for H naught is. And here, of course, there's some uncertainty due to the jerk and snap parameters Q and J here, but most of the observations are at relatively small Z, and so the determination of H naught in this case is quite insensitive to those uncertainties. So this is how H naught is extracted from observations of Pythagoric supernovae. Now, from the cosmic microwave background, what's really done is that you take all of the data from the CMB and you use a Boltzmann code to extract that. Now, the thing is, with a Boltzmann code, there are a huge number of effects that are taken into account. And this is something that's very precise, but it can be quite difficult to get your hands on the underlying physics. And so what I want to do here is just give an approximation, which isn't quite as precise as using the Boltzmann code, but it's still reasonably accurate, and it makes it much simpler to understand what's going on in the background. So this simpler, more direct determination of H-naught is based on the angular location of the acoustic peaks in the CMB, and these have been measured to extreme accuracy. So we know exactly very well what this data parameter is. And this is given by the sound horizon divided by the radius to the surface of last scattering. Now, the sound horizon is just simply how far a wave could have traveled in the CMB plasma between the time of reheating and the time that the CMB formed. So it's just the integral of the sound speed, here C sub s, between those two times. And then the other term is the radius to the surface of last scattering. And just a quick geometrical calculation shows you that this is the integral over redshifts of 1 over h as a function of z. So if I can calculate these two quantities, then I know what theta is. And of course, I can compare that to observations where theta is very well known. Now, let me point out that the sound horizon depends only on pre-CMB physics. So it really depends on how fast waves can travel in the plasma before the CMB forms. So in what follows, I'm going to assume that the diffusion that we're picking up in unimodular gravity only becomes important at later times. And so this sound horizon is not affected by any diffusion. So I'm going to assume that the sound horizon R sub s is completely unaffected by diffusion and is the same as in the standard GR linear CD picture. So I'm really going to focus on the second term, which is the radius of last scattering. And this depends on the dynamics of the universe. And so if I look at the standard GR lambda CDM cosmology, I get the following dynamics that's shown in equation 22. And I can express the Hubble rate as a function of the redshift in terms of the Hubble rate today, H-naught, and the contribution today to the radiation, matter, and cosmological constant term. And as Z increases, as we go further back in time, then the term to radiation increases very quickly, and the term to matter increases quite quickly as well, whereas the term coming from the cosmological constant remains fixed. And so what we can do is that we can now, from this, we can extract the relative values of radiation, matter, and cosmological constant from the CMB, as well as the sound horizon. We can measure the angle theta, and from that, we can determine what the radius of last scattering is. And by knowing omega r, omega m, and omega lambda, we can then find what H-naught has to be. And so that is a relatively direct way to extract H-naught from the CMB data. Okay, before going on, are there any questions about this? Okay, if not, then let me go to the next part. So here I've explained how this would be calculated if we want to calculate H-naught for the standard GR lambda CDM cosmology. Now, what happens if we have some diffusion? Well, in that case, my cosmological constant will depend on time, so equation 22 doesn't hold anymore. Instead, I'll get a different expression for the Hubble rate as a function of redshift. And this will lead to a different inferred value for H naught. So the question is, can this resolve the H naught tension? And as I will argue in the following, the answer is yes. So there's a question, go ahead.
Just a quick question. Your definition of capital Omega, isn't it normally rho divided by rho critical?
Yes, that's right. So here I'm assuming a flat Friedman universe in GR.
Okay, so already rho critical, okay.
That's right. In general, I should be more careful with the denominator there. You're absolutely correct. Okay, so let me go on to explain how diffusion changes this picture. So to check to see whether diffusion can resolve the H-naught tension, I'll do the following. First, I will take the value of H-naught as measured by supernova observations. And for the sake of argument, I'm going to assume that that is the correct value and that the value which we obtain from observations of the CMB is incorrect because we assume GR lambda CM dynamics, which will now be corrected by diffusion. So first, I take the value of H naught measured by supernova observations. And two, I take the values of the energy densities of the different matter fields. So radiation, matter. And when I say matter here, I include both dark matter and baryonic matter, as inferred from observations of the CMB. And then I'll use the equations of motion that include the diffusion effects that have a lambda which depends on time. So that those are the equations that we saw earlier in the first part of the talk. So from the second and the third points, we can infer what the value of H naught is if we take the observations of the CMB and we add these diffusion effects. And then we can compare this to what is found by the direct observations of supernova. And so the question that we have to ask is whether we can obtain a value following this process, which is in agreement with what we find from the supernova observations. Okay, so now I have to remind you that we do need some input from fundamental physics in order to determine what lambda t is. So if you have a theory of quantum gravity that explains how matter interacts with the microscopic geometric degrees of freedom, then presumably possible to extract what this function lambda of t is. Here, I'm not doing that. Instead, I'm just going to take two very simple phenomenological models. And this is more a way of arguing that this is one possible way to resolve the H-naught tension, rather than saying that there's a specific model that we believe is the correct one. So to have a specific model, we really should come from a full theory of quantum gravity. So here I only want to show that this process is viable. Okay, so I'll look at two models. In the first one, I'm going to assume that diffusion occurs very suddenly. So my cosmological constant is some constant. And then all of a sudden, at some value of redshift, z star, then my lambda increases by some quantity, delta lambda here. Now, it turns out to be convenient to use the following quantity, alpha. And the exact expression is given in equation 24. But what I really want you to remember is just that 1 minus alpha is the fraction of energy that's lost to diffusion. And here I'm assuming that all of the diffusion is coming from the matter components. So dark matter and very dark matter. So I have some amount, some contribution to the energy density coming from matter. And then all of a sudden, when the redshift is equal to z star, there's a fraction of that energy which is lost to diffusion, and that fraction is 1 minus alpha. Okay, so in terms of these quantities, I can rewrite my lambda of z here. And the details here don't matter so much. All that I want to emphasize is that there are three free parameters. So there's lambda infinity, the constant value that it had in the past. Then I have this alpha term here, which shows up. And then this sudden transfer of energy from matter to lambda occurs at redshift z star. So these are my three free parameters. So the question is, with this, is it possible to resolve the H-naught tension? And what we see here is that it is. So what I've done is offset lambda infinity to the normal value for the cosmological constant that we have in GR lambda CDM. Because of course, this diffusion effect has to be small. So for simplicity, I'm just going to set lambda to be its standard value. And then for the other two parameters, I have them in the plot here on the right. So 1 minus alpha, remember, tells you how much of the energy density is transferred into lambda. And z star is the redshift at which this occurs. And the dashed line, which I'm following here with my cursor, is the region where the tension is resolved. So the value of H naught calculated starting from observations of the CMB when including these diffusion effects gives exactly the same value as that found by the direct observations of supernova on the dashed line. And the solid lines give the 1 and 2 sigma contours around the supernova data. And what we also see is we can calculate what the density, what the contribution to omega m would be today, according to these models. And in the best fit area, we find that it's 0.26, which is a little bit lower than what's preferred by the CMB, assuming GR lambda CDM. And this, of course, makes sense because in this model, there is a transfer of energy from matter to lambda. And so that shows up in omega m naught. So in this plot, I'm showing what happens if z star is relatively small, so between 5 and 10. But of course, we could also allow for z star to be much larger, and this is what I show in the next plot. And we see again that it's possible to resolve the H-naught tension. And as we go further back to larger and larger redshifts, we see that the amount that has to be transferred from matter to lambda gets smaller and smaller. But despite that, we still find that today, omega m would still be around 0.26 in the best fit region. Are there any questions about this model? Okay, if not, then let me go on to the second one. So the first one, we had a very sharp transition where diffusion occurred suddenly. So all of a sudden, there was a large amount of diffusion that was transferred from the matter content to lambda. And of course, that doesn't seem very realistic, at least for diffusion. So instead, we also wanted to look at a model where this diffusion happens more gradually. And in the second model, what we'll assume is that starting at some value of z star, dark matter starts to decay anomalously. So the energy density of matter goes like 1 over the scale factor to the power of 3 plus gamma, rather than 1 over the scale factor to the power of 3. And here gamma we assume is positive because we want that small, we want it to decay faster than we would expect with the extra amount is what's lost into diffusion. And from this, we can calculate what lambda of t is. Again, we have a constant prefactor, and then some term which depends on this, both the anomalous exponent gamma and z star, so the instant when this diffusion starts to occur. And there's some prefactor A here, which is determined entirely by gammons at star, but its exact form isn't important here. Now here, I'm assuming that the anomalous decay only starts when Z is equal to Z star and then continues for later times or for smaller redshifts. But of course, we can easily set Z star equal to 1,090. And in this case, diffusion will just occur continuously from recombination on. So that possibility is included in this model. So now this gives a model where lambda really is continuous. And we have, again, three parameters. So the constant term, and then the anomalous exponent gamma, and Z star. So we can go ahead and look at the results. Again, I'll set the constant term in lambda to be the preferred value in lambda CDM. And again, we see that with this model, we're able to resolve the Hubble tension. And again, this is resolved along the dashed line in this plot here. And what we see is that if this diffusion starts for large values at star, then the anomalous exponent gamma becomes much, much smaller. And in particular, you can continue this graph to very large values of Z star, and then gamma will become very, very small. Okay, any questions about this model? Yes, go ahead.
Yes, there have been several papers published in which they make dark energy vary.
And, yes.
So the issue is that the two issues come out into play. The Planck measurement of the vacuum equation state W equal to minus one is known to a few percent, which reflects a constant cosmological constant. And the second point is that the problem with lots of the papers that have been published on this issue of the Hubble tension, they fall into tension when you try to fit all of the data. You have to fit the acoustical power spectrum, the matter power spectrum, the BAO and lensing and so on. So the question is, well, these two questions, do you get into trouble?
Right. So let me answer the first one first, and I'll come back to the second one after. So if I look at the Friedman equation here in equation 11, I don't show you the Reichardt-Urey equation, but I could. It's exactly the same thing as in general relativity, except, again, the cosmological constant is replaced by the lambda t term. And it turns out that this really behaves as something with an equation of state that is equal to minus one. And so this is a little surprising, but it shows up in the Friedman and Reichardt-Urey equations with an equation of state is minus one, even though lambda depends on t. So for the first point, I don't think there are any problems here. For the second point, that's of course very important, we need to be able to match not only the H-naught tension, but all of the other observations also. And we haven't checked that in detail yet. So that's something that we have to do. Now, I do think that this won't change things too much because this is a relatively small effect, but this is certainly something that has to be checked.
Yeah, because there'd be two possibilities to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. One is to have an early universe change, something happens, but prior to the CMB in the radiation dominated era.
And the that's right. So late, if you change the sound horizon, you're also able to address the H naught tension. That's correct.
If you lower the sound horizon, then you have to increase the density somewhere to compensate. And this, if you try it. If you do this at late time, it doesn't work. And if you do it early times, you can get into trouble with fitting the data.
And all of you're right. And I'll say a little bit more about this on the next slide, but that's one of the issues that we have to be careful about, because here, to try and understand the underlying physics, we've really used this more direct way of calculating H-naught from the CMB. What we really should do is use a Boltzmann code, and so that's work in progress right now. And then from that, we'll get an even stronger idea of how well this works. And we can also then apply it to other types of observations once we have that. So you're absolutely right. There are other observations that have to fall into line for this to be viable. Okay, so I am pretty much done. As promised, this was a relatively short talk. So in summary, it is possible to include diffusion effects in unimodular gravity. And the result is that you get a lambda, which depends on space-time position. And in cosmology, if you assume homogeneity, then it just depends on time. And we looked at two phenomenological models where we found that it is possible to resolve the H-naught tension. So I think this is quite encouraging. Of course, there is a lot of future work to be done. So the specific form of lambda depends on fundamental physics. So this has to be some input explaining how matter interacts with these microscopic degrees of freedom and how this energy transfer can occur. So this presumably will be given to us by some fundamental theory of quantum gravity, hopefully. Of course, it may turn out that there is no diffusion and then this is ruled out, but the point is that this lambda of T term has to be fixed by fundamental physics. So here we looked at some phenomenological models, but in the future it'd be very nice to develop specific models motivated by fundamental physics. And based on that fundamental physics, figure out what the exact form of lambda of T is, and then see, can this resolve the H-naught tension, or are there other effects that we can look for? And the other thing which is very important, which I just mentioned, is that we also want to use the Boltzmann code to obtain a more accurate constraint on these models. All right, so let me stop here and thank you for your attention.
All right, thank you, Ed. Okay, so as usual, we start with students and postdoc, and then we move on to the rest of the crowd. So if there are questions from students or postdoc. That doesn't seem to be the case. Then Lee, go on.
Hi, so thank you very much. That was very interesting. I think the theory you've been developing is very close to the theory we developed with a bunch of people, Stefan Alexander, Marina Cortez, Andrew Little, Zhao Miguezhou. And we hid the derivative of lambda in the value of the torsion rather than in the additional degree of freedom given by unimodular gravity. But I think it doesn't need a long discussion now, but perhaps we could discuss sometime later. I think we get exactly the same cosmological model as you.
Okay, that would be very interesting. We should definitely discuss.
Thank you.
I have a question. Hello?
Sure.
Hey, go on.
Hey, just a naive question. So here you look at the effect of this current, on the cosmological universe. But can you think about correlated effects? Like, can the thing act as a dark matter in galaxies or otherwise? I mean, if you change some of the coupling of gravity to matter, doesn't it, affect other gravitational system?
So what happens here, and it was quite surprising to me at first, is that really the only effect is that you have a time-dependent lambda. So I agree.
Yes, in a cosmological universe, but suppose you look at the field of a galaxy, then there's going to be some, like, I mean, it's going to be a change of, doesn't it change the Newton equation, for instance?
Let me go back here. So in equation 9, mm-hmm. this is the equation that we get. And really the only modification is that now we have a lambda which depends on space-time position. And so this is the general equation.
So does that affect the, you know, okay, so you're saying,
so what I'm saying,
what sets up the scale of variation of that of that J?
Can it vary, well, that will presumably come from fundamental physics.
Can it vary over, you know, size of galaxies?
Possibly. So
then there would be effects, right?
That's right. But those effects, I don't think they would look like dark matter.
Okay.
That's something worth investigating. But you could certainly have effects if you ask that J vary a fair bit. But
or is there a back of the envelope reasoning that says that the variation of J has to, if it comes from quantum gravity, you know, what is the scale at which it should, it's plausible it happens?
I'm not aware of any back of the envelope calculations that address that point. From my perspective so far, I've just said, okay, this is a classical theory and let me leave J unknown. Now, if someone says, oh, I have a theory of quantum gravity that predicts a certain form for J, then we can certainly use that.
But without the theory of quantum gravity, you mentioned the diffusion effect, right?
Yes.
So sometimes, no, you don't necessarily need the full theory to understand. You need an assumptions about the diffusion constant.
That's right. That's right.
So for the Brownian motion, you don't need to understand everything.
That's right. And that's what I like about this. It's quite simple. But it's, let's say if you look at just, you know, Newton's second law and putting in some friction term, right? Do you put in something which is proportional to the velocity squared, the constant drag term? This depends on the situation. And at this stage, I'm not sure what the correct answer is for J here. Mm-hmm.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
If I understand, the unit modular gravity has root minus g equal to 1 as a charge.
Yes, that's another way of
doing it. For Einstein's paper from 1915-16, he used root minus g equal to 1 to simplify all the calculations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, before that, when he was trying to derive his field equations, he published a paper with the traceless energy momentum tensor. And Hilbert wrote a letter to him complaining that you can't do this because it's not a proper explanation for matter. So then he went on to the last paper he published, 1915, mm-hmm. the so-called Einstein field equations. So this does have a history to it. If you have root minus g equal to 1, you've chosen a specific coordinate system, so to speak. It's a constraint. And
right.
one could worry about that, but I don't know. What is your opinion?
So I agree that that's a different way of presenting unimodular gravity. And as you say, it does turn out to be equivalent at the end of the day, but you might worry that this depends on a specific choice of coordinates. And so this is why I like using equation 4 here, because it's clear that equation 4 doesn't depend on any choice of coordinates. And so in that sense, it's a little bit safer. But it's equivalent, I agree.
It's just that that equation is for the right hand side is for the maximum energy momentum tensor, which is traceless. Matter is not traceless.
Right. So if you put in matter on the right hand side, you'll get something which is non-zero.
Okay.
This so this is equivalent to requiring that the determinant of the metric be minus one, but it's not exactly the same. So I think Einstein proposed essentially equation four, except without the last term on the right here. I could be wrong about this, though. This is really just from memory.
I think he did that with the stipulation that he was only considering radiation, which was trace free.
Okay. Okay, in that case, it would be the same.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's obvious. It's just a Maxwell Einstein equations. If you add Maxwell's equations.
Sure. But yeah, so it is important here to stress that in equation four, the right hand side is non-vanishing for matter.
Yeah. It's a bit odd, but anyway.
Yeah. Lee, you have another question?
Just very quick. How do you count your numbers of degrees of freedom? Because you, by letting lambda be a free function, so you lose, in a sense, you lose a degree of freedom. You lose a parameter. You no longer have as a parameter the cosmological constant. Somewhere when you add matter, you get some constraint between the matter and the value, the energy density due to the cosmological constant. Or do you avoid that?
So here you have to... so if we go back here, by using the Bianchi identities, you are able to get back to the Einstein equations. And so you still have your two gravitational degrees of freedom, and then you have to couple it to matter. So depending on the matter that you add, you have a certain number of matter degrees of freedom, and you have to postulate how that is conserved or not. So you'll have to provide some equations of motion for the matter and determine what the J current would be for each of those. But on the geometrical side, you still have 2 degrees of freedom.
Right, but the J is in the end partly free.
That will have to be fixed by the equations of motion of the matter field.
Right, that's what I thought. So in the end, do you have fewer degrees of freedom, fewer initial value equations, or more degrees of freedom than general relativity per point?
I think it's exactly the same. It's just your equations of motion that are slightly different.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
I just want to make one comment again about the that there are several papers I've read where they try to do the variation of dark energy as away from a constant.
Yes.
And one gets the impression that they get into trouble with fitting all the data. You can't cherry pick the data. You have to fit the data. So I would suggest that you check this carefully.
Yes, we absolutely will. Thank you.
I have a related question. I mean, given that the ambiguity is an arbitrary function, J, couldn't you say, in fact, that the problem is that you can fit any data you want because this is an infinite ambiguity? So any data you give me, I can always fit it with my function J.
Yes, so that's true. So I think here, maybe a good analogy is inflation. So there again, you have some scalar field with some potential, and this potential you can choose freely. And so in principle, you could fit almost anything by choosing your potential carefully. And this actually is an argument that Penrose has made. And so the same is true here. If you just let J be completely free and you fix it to be whatever you want, I expect, yeah, you could fit almost anything. But this is where I think it's important to keep in mind that ideally this is coming from some fundamental physics. So if you have a proposed theory of fundamental physics, then that would hopefully tell you what form J could have. Yeah, and then that can be constrained.
I agree. And that's why I want to push you in that direction. So what are the, you know, whatever, given your favorite model on quantum gravity, what are the plausible constraints you expect J to satisfy? Otherwise,
yeah, no, I agree with that. And at this stage, I'm not sure. But that was one of the, you know, two main points in the future work. And I think that's an important one. I agree.
Okay. Thanks.
Yep.
So actually, already this, didn't Alejandro and Daniel had an actual expression for this J at some point, in the sense they were trying to predict the value of lambda, right?
That's right. So let me just go back here. So they have put forward two specific realizations. So I have the references here. And the idea is now, what do those say? And so the first proposal in 2018, that one's quite specific, but it turns out that what really happens is that everything happens before the CMB. And there's no way for that to resolve the H-Mach tension. So it does give a value for the cosmological constant that is in good agreement with observations, but it won't resolve the H-Mach tension. And more recently, they've put forward another proposal that potentially could, but there's more work that's needed there to make it to understand the exact form of J that comes out. So there is work in this direction.
So the reasoning here is that you don't assume, you don't derive a value of H naught, but you assume one, and from that you try to fit the model.
So what I think the way to think of this is that you have some, so at least in these two cases, these two references here, mm-hmm. you come up with some microscopic model, and that will give you some form of J with perhaps some free parameters. And then you can fix those free parameters by then comparing with observations. And in particular, for example, the H-naught tension, which I focused on here.
Yeah, right. So you don't try to predict lambda, but you try to fix the tension by using one value of H-naught and make it the same for the different method of deriving H-naught. Is that
right? So yeah. So we have two different ways of measuring it, and one depends crucially on the dynamics between the formation of the CMB and today.
Right.
And so then we can constrain diffusion by requiring that these two methods match.
No more questions?
All right. Well, thank you very much, everyone, for logging in and for your questions.
All right, then let's thank Ed again.